Hello there. How are you? It's a fantastic day here at Breakfast All Day. It's a busy day.
First day of March.
It is. It's March 1st. And we're happy to see you guys. And we had a really good little run going there for a while of the four of us. And now it's the three of us today. Christy, Alonzo, Matt, hello. Ben might show up at some point to talk about True Detective with us.
Perhaps.
We hope.
But maybe not. But if he doesn't, it's been a good run,
yes.
Like an unprecedented run of like 4 weeks together. We will try to make up for the lovely Ben's absence. We've got a big random week of stuff. There's not really anything giant now that we're coming out of the Oscars and we're not quite into the beginning of the summer movies yet, like sort of a weird mid-zone. So we've got some mid-sized stuff and some smaller stuff for you.
I think everybody's afraid that, oh, well, there's a Marvel movie opening next weekend, and let's give it wide berth. You know?
There is.
And well, they should.
Yeah, you've seen Captain Marvel, Matt.
Yes, I have.
But I'm seeing it Monday night, which I'm
Same
very excited
here.
About, so we'll have that for you next week. But first, for this week, we're going to start with another movie about strong, interesting women. Greta, Matt, will you describe? Actually, I'm going to describe Greta.
Why don't you describe
Why
Greta?
Why don't I describe
Why
Greta? Because I'm the girl.
You like chewing gum.
This is,
I
do stick around. This is an unabashed B movie with A-plus talent and production values.
Yes, this is an A-plus B movie.
It is. And so Chloe Grace Moretz plays a recent college graduate who is living in New York with her best friend, played by Micah Monroe, who's always good. And they're living in this fantastic loft downtown. And one day on the way home from work, Chloe Grace Moretz, whose character's name is Francis finds a purse that someone has left behind on the seat of the subway.
A nice, elegant purse.
Right. A very fancy purse. And in this magical version of New York where no one's afraid of packages that have been left behind on the subway, she picks it up and takes it home with her and then decides to go and track down the person who it belongs to, who is Isabelle Huppert. And they strike up this kind of unlikely, unexpected, but seemingly really sweet friendship.
Right, because Frances has recently lost her mother.
Right.
And she's not native to New York. And in fact, that comes up when she first brings the purse home because her roommate's like, are you kidding?
Yeah.
Oh, there's money? This is just our money now, right? Mm-hmm. Like her roommate does what you would expect a regular or a classic movie stereotypical New Yorker, yeah, which is, oh, this is ours. Hey, free purse, free money. Let's go out. It's massages for both of us. And Frances, who is portrayed as someone who's more thoughtful and more innocent, is like, no, I'm going to return this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's still, I mean, she's lost her mother recently and they were very, very close. Mm-hmm. And that leads to this relationship with her and Greta, because she very much finds this kind of mother figure in Greta and, you know, helps her adopt the dog and they want to spend time together.
They make dinner together.
They make dinner. And
it's really nice.
It's very
it
nice.
It seems.
And then
until it isn't.
Until it isn't. And then Frances discovers something like, wait, what?
It's shocking.
And then the movie goes even more sideways from there. It keeps ramping up and keeps getting more and more bonkers, and it becomes this stalker mystery thriller, and it's awesome. It's awesome because it's unabashedly over the top. It completely, like, it really gets right to the edge of, like, okay, I'm not going to believe this. And maybe sometimes if it does cross that line, that's okay, because you're having, like, everybody's clearly kind of having a fun time with this, mm-hmm, and it's lurid and it's melodramatic, and I loved this. And, you know, there was a point I turned to you, I'm like, oh, here's what's going on.
And you were right. I'm not going to say what
it
is,
okay.
But Matt was right.
But that's okay. it's nutso and super fun.
It is. And I tweeted this, but I mean, there are multiple moments in which I just flat out screamed in your ear, Matt.
Yeah.
And like, we're sitting next to one another, grabbing onto, thankfully, a very thick leather jacket, because I have my nails dug into his jacket so many times. I mean, it is a visceral experience.
Yeah.
It is so much fun. It is so intense. And I mean, problematic if you really want to think about what they're saying here about what all is going on with Greta's character. I mean, it's a typical kind of like crazy stalker movie villain. You know, maybe there are like shreds of sympathy for her.
How does it compare to what was the Judi Dench, Cate Blanchett movie?
Oh, that was great. Oh, what was that? Now I got to look that up on IMDb.
That was also Stalkery.
It's very similar. Okay, so now I got... why?
Sorry, I didn't mean to throw us
off. No, 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 that's a good point.
I haven't seen Greta yet, but
the
description made me think of it.
And also, you know, of course, single white female is also... Notes on a Scandal.
Notes on a Scandal,
It's like that in that you have people who have done really serious work with really serious... Neil Jordan directed this.
Yeah.
You know? So this is like a serious filmmaker, and but one who will go to dangerous, weird places and uncomfortable, emotional places. It's like that in that it's a really like exquisite guilty pleasure. It's like, it's like delightful trash.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of an exercise in like, oh, hey, let's all just screw around in this genre. And do something dopey and silly and doesn't really have any deeper meaning to it. But they, you know, it's
meticulous.
But yeah, and you know, everybody puts their all in, and you know, you can bring skill to something that would otherwise be this kind of like forgettable throwaway type of film, and they make it really enjoyable. Like, there's plenty of people that would, there's plenty of filmmakers, plenty of talent that would aspire to try and do something this well. And you know, does it feel at times like, could we look at this and say like, oh, Jordan's kind of slumming here? Maybe, but you know what? That's okay. Like, it's great.
Well, and let's not forget, I mean, Neil Jordan did begin his career with In the Company of Wolves, which is on the one hand, this like really great sort of metaphorical sort of brutal Bruno Bettelheim, you know, sexual coming of age metaphor, blah, blah, blah. But it's also, you know, a werewolf movie. and you know, and he did Interview with the Vampire. Right. So he has always sort of had one foot in a certain kind of genre filmmaking. Even something like, you know, The Butcher Boy is about a serial killer.
There's a lurid side to him, but it's artful. I mean, Seamus McGarvey shot this. He is a DP who shot like Atonement and Anna Karenina and Bad Times at the El Royale, which we all loved so well. So it looks beautiful.
But we love looking at it.
Right now, there's like a fluid, there's like a fluid elegance to it. There's a creaminess to it, and like a textural kind of substance to it in what is just trash. I mean, it's really, really fun trash. Isabelle Huppert, she goes for it. She's having a blast. I mean, there is no winking and nodding here. It's like she is laser focused on the insanity. And there are so many moments here where it's like, don't go down there. Don't go in that hall.
Oh, yeah.
Get out. Open the door. Get out.
Like, there's a lot of yelling at the screen in this one.
It's a good screaming at the screen movie. It's intense. I think if you want a movie to go with friends and just go have a blast. If you guys are on Twitter, there are already like multiple memes, and like there's a scene where Isabelle Huppert like flips a table over, and that's already been used in multiple places. So,
oh, yeah, you know, really good table flip in this one.
The movie hasn't even come out yet. And I mean, is there a stigmatizing to what all Isabelle Huppert's character is going through? Maybe. You know,
sure,
but she's not a good person. She's troubled. She needs help.
Did you come away with any like fashion tips?
Fashion tips?
Yeah.
Why?
This just seems like a kind of movie where they're horrible but really well dressed.
I mean, she wears. Yeah, I mean, there are like great little coats and great hats, and there's very plot specific use of gloves.
Right. Oh yeah,
like Carol.
Yeah, oh, no, yeah. There's a very old-fashioned...
Yeah, exactly like Carol.
There's an old-fashioned nature to a lot of the look of it. I mean, it takes place now, and that is useful technology-wise, plot-wise, but there is sort of a classic kind of stalker vibe to it where the film could take place at any point in time. Yeah, and Micah Monroe is good as always, as like the voice of reason. And her character's interesting, too, because she's admittedly kind of vapid and kind of self-centered, kind of, you know, bitchy rich girl, but then... You know, she very much is loyal to Chloe Grace Moretz's character.
Well, and she calls herself out that way.
And will protect her.
Yeah, I mean, early on, she's like, oh, yeah, one of the fights that she has with Frances early on is, or not early on, but she has this fight with Frances. Like, you know, you like to think that I'm just this vapid idiot, right? And there is a little bit, like, she is written as a real person.
Yeah. And Chloe Grace Moretz, I mean, she has to kind of be the straight person to allow Isabelle Huppert to just go nuts. And it's fun to watch. Anyway, so I had a blast. I'm giving it an 8.5, and you should go see it with your friends.
Yeah, I give it a 9. I think it's super fun. It's awesome.
You can't see this movie by yourself, by the way.
No.
You cannot. You need to have the conversation afterward. You need to have the camaraderie of the experience. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bring people. I look forward to hearing your thoughts.
Yeah, no, I know David you're and I are going this weekend for sure.
Yeah. So you have a person to see it with, yes, to clutch on to when things get scary. So our number is 8.7? No, 8.8. If we're 8.5 and 9.
Yeah. 8.8.
And it is, you guys, it's only at 60% on the tomato meter.
People are jerks.
It's been waffling in that 59-60 range for a while. And I don't know why. I don't know what is wrong with you people that you didn't just go and have a blast like we did. So if you guys go see it, you'll have to let us know what you think. So that, so 60 is our number. Go see Greta. Oh, my. It's that magical time where we talk about a new Tyler Perry movie, Tyler Perry's A Madea Family Funeral, which you will all be shocked to learn was not screened for critics before opening day.
Surprise!
As they tend not to be. I think they haven't screened a single Tyler Perry movie since
for
Diary of a
Girl.
Mad Black Woman.
No, no, for Colored
Girls. Oh, they
girls,
did. Oh, yeah.
Because he thought
that's
that
right
was going to be his Oscar movie,
yes,
I remember.
Oh, well.
But yeah, not since.
Yeah, so Alonzo and Dave and I all went and saw the new Madea movie last night.
I yes didn't.
So, it's a funeral. there's not a ton of plot here. Basically, Madea, Joe, Cassie, and Hattie, and Brian, who is that's the one character that Tyler Perry plays without excessive makeup on his face, are traveling to an anniversary party of, I can never keep track of who's related to who.
So it's some
is Vian,
other brother.
Is Anthony related to them, or is Vian Anthony related to them?
It's some relation of some sort.
Okay. Somebody's cousin or something is having a 40th anniversary party, so they all show up. But unfortunately, the husband picks that very day to drop dead of a heart attack while having sex with another woman in a hotel, the hotel where they're all staying, so they all know the circumstances behind it.
Man, go out, do something you love.
Yeah. Well.
Not just any kind of sex, though.
Oh, yeah. It's
super kinky S&M sex.
Well, it's PG-13 kinky S&M sex, mm-hmm, so the woman is wearing like a, you know, full sort of black leather bodice, and there's reference to him having a ball gag in, yeah, his mouth, but we never see it. Anyway, meanwhile, the dead guy's oldest older son is having an affair with the younger son's fiance, so that's all happening.
And the older son is also married.
Yes.
To a woman that he is horrible to all, yes, the time, yes.
And so, you know, it's a Tyler Perry movie. So basically, when Madea and Joe and a new senior citizen character played by Tyler Perry named Heathrow, who has amputated legs and an electrolarynx, are on screen, then it's funny. And when they're not on screen, it's not funny. And even when they are on screen, the movie is a series of people sitting around in a circle and having conversations. Like, every other scene is that, which if you watched Boo 2 or a lot of other recent Perry films, you'll see is sort of his favorite configuration because apparently everything he knows about directing, he learned in community theater.
Also, he likes when they're all standing in a row. So like one of the early scenes we see of all the kids of the couple with the anniversary, they're like all standing behind the island of this really
kitchen,
nice,
yeah,
kitchen.
Like they're on a sitcom.
There's like four people all standing in a row. And the lighting is super like flat and bright. Like he's made what? And I know we have this conversation every time.
First feature film.
He still does not know where to put the camera.
No, and this movie is lit like it's. It looks like the first movie that was made entirely in motion smoothing. It's terrible looking, and you know the first scene is all these characters standing around the kitchen, and we don't know who any of them are.
No, we get dropped in
just like plop. Here we go.
And it's not like it's a sequel to anything where you need to have seen the previous one. Like,
no,
we just don't even know who they are.
I mean, I'm sure somebody online has mapped out the extensive family tree of all these people, but like, I don't think this is a branch of the family we've encountered before in previous Madea films.
No. Are we saying that there's another MCU, a Madea cinematic universe?
There apparently is. Yeah.
Now, Perry has been saying that this is his final Madea movie, which would suck because it's not one of the better ones. And I will go on record as saying there are some good Madea movies. He's so funny as Madea.
He is.
And as Uncle Joe and even as Heathrow.
Heathrow is inappropriate.
It very, but has a lot of funny stuff. It's like, and it just makes me insane that A, he is so phoning it in when it comes to the rest of the movie. Like, there's one monologue at the end of the movie that the widow gets to make that's kind of like, oh, like, where was this energy the rest of the
right
movie? Like,
there's acting to be had here.
Yeah, like somebody might have actually done something or said something of interest. But, you know, and I was thinking about this. I just wrote my review for The Wrap. It's like Perry is so good in other people's movies, mm-hmm. like in Gone Girl and in Vice. I would love him to play Madea in a movie that somebody else directed.
Right.
And
so maybe, not Tyler Perry's Madea something.
Exactly.
It's like
starring Tyler right. Perry.
Baz Luhrmann's Tyler Perry's
Madea. Neil Jordan's.
And maybe even like co-written with somebody else where like Tyler Perry would write the Madea scenes and the other person would write the rest of the movie because it's the rest of the movie where this thing falls apart.
But as we see, which is often the case, there are wacky outtakes during the closing credits.
Always.
And so who even knows how much is written?
Oh,
like,
yeah, no.
Written by Tyler Perry is him riffing in a dress.
He's improvising like mad. Yeah. And again, that's still way more energetic than the rest of the movie is.
Yeah, no.
Because everybody else is just sort of stuck with his sort of, like, flat melodrama dialogue, which, you know, and it's very much like one of his stage plays in that there's these sort of, like, you know, family members who are screwing each other over and lying and being hypocrites. And then at the end, Madea tells them all what for. And then we all go home.
Right.
Know.
I will say, though, that I told Chris this when I got home last night. It's bad in the way that all Tyler Perry movies are bad and good in the way that all Tyler Perry movies are good. But this seemed less churchy to me than most. I mean, actively so in terms of making fun of one of the better scenes is making fun of
the Black funeral,
the Black Baptist Church funeral, and like just how interminable they are and how indulgent they are. I mean, yeah, it's affectionately toying with a staple of Black culture, but like there's honesty to that and there's a pointedness to that that seems missing in a lot of his films that tried to be way more biblical.
Yeah.
Also, it tries in a scene to address the whole like Black Lives Matter.
That's
phenomenon.
One of the better parts of the movie.
That goes nowhere.
No, eventually, yeah. But they get pulled over by a traffic cop, and Brian, the non putty covered Brian, a Tyler Perry character, is, you know, like, no, this is why like people just need to obey the police, and that's why, you know, these things go wrong.
Put your hand on the wheel.
Yeah, and all the older people are like, no, this is not good. This is not good. And of course, the cop is, you know, terrible to him until he finds out
and
he's
white.
A lawyer
and white
and screaming and like, you know. Like, it's a no-win situation. And it's a funny scene, and it at least flirts with an idea. You're right, it kind of peters out, but at least it goes somewhere.
It's trying to make a point about what it is like to be Black in America right now, but not with any kind of, like, the intelligence or the pointedness of many other films that are doing that so well. I felt like that was a missed opportunity. Like, he's trying to use his clout and his audience to really say something from a venue that we don't ordinarily see, and then it just kind of...
I mean, it's no The Hate You Give, but it's something. I admire the attempt.
He tried.
Anyway, you know, and you're right. The movies have gotten less sort of Jesus as he's gone along. I mean, Madea has always sort of been like the joke is that she never goes to church and that, you know, it used to be that she smoked weed. They kind of don't do that as much anymore.
But you she's know, profane and inappropriate.
Exactly. Yeah. But nonetheless sensible and maybe is I think the idea is that she may be less churchy than the other characters, but she is living the tenets of Bible in a better way than most people who claim to be, you know, sanctimonious, but who are actually like, you know, hypocrites or whatever. I think people kind of dismiss these movies out of hand without having seen them. And it's like, Madea as a comic creation is great. I will insist and die on this hill. I love Madea. But I wish that Madea got, like, a Duck Soup. I think I've said this before in reviews, too. Like, the Marx Brothers, Duck Soup is their best movie because there's no, like, ingenue romance. There's no not funny musical numbers that don't serve any purpose. Like, it's just a straightforward, concentrated dose of Marx Brothers anarchy. And I would love to see a Madea movie that was that focused on the nuttiness of her and Uncle Joe and Aunt Bam and those characters and just skip the other stuff that's never any fun to watch.
Right. We are then stuck with it veering from the delightful nuttiness to like sanctimoniousness.
Yeah.
And it's always this like whiplash inducing yanking back and forth tonally. And I guess that's also part of what you buy into when you buy a ticket to a Tyler Perry movie, because he's always going to want to hit every single note and he's never going to do it in a way that is elegant or fluid.
Pretty much.
I think maybe by now he figures this is baked into the experience.
Yes.
This is what you expect. And if I made a coherent film, that would be bizarre.
Right. Well, maybe. I don't know how much, I don't know what the line is between I don't want to lose my well-established audience.
The base.
That has come, exactly, the base, that has come to see these movies knowing exactly what they are and loving what they are versus can he even do a movie that isn't that?
Like, we don't know.
We don't know, because he's very comfortable in his wheelhouse, so we don't really know how large that wheelhouse is.
Yes. Anyway, so we had a good time. You know, again, like Greta, which we just discussed, this is a good movie to see with friends.
Yes.
Go and laugh at the ridiculousness of it all. Have some fun with your friends. We did.
Yeah. So what was your number?
My number is a 4.
I said 4.5.
I have seen some folks out there saying this is the best Madea movie in 10 years.
Oh,
I'm not. I'm not sure about that. Yeah, it still looks like crap technically. Oh, my favorite thing, I leaned over to Alonzo and mentioned this, like, the continuity, they're not even trying. There's a scene where they leave the house. They leave the house for the hospital.
It's nighttime.
And it's nighttime.
And they come back to a different house.
No. The party's happening at night. They leave at night. You can see outside it's dark. And then the next scene, the very next scene, is in the hospital waiting room, and it's bright daylight coming through the windows.
Yes.
Like, nobody even tried.
Maybe it was a long drive.
I was going to say, like, it's not even like they've been waiting all night and now it's the next morning. It's like...
No, it's minutes have passed.
It's just like the immediate moment afterward. And I'm like, wait, I lean over to Alonzo and I go, wait, wasn't it just nighttime? I'm so confused.
Dave and I had mentioned that too. By the way, it is not the best Madea movie in the last 10 years, because Madea's Big Happy Family came out in 2011, and that is the best Madea movie of the last 10 years.
I recall also having a really good time at Boo, a Madea Halloween.
The first Boo was okay.
The first Boo was fun.
Yeah.
Never forget your first Boo.
Yeah. For your mindless eye candy, every single man in this is shirtless at some point, and they're all like increasingly muscular,
including the dead guy.
Yeah, to the point where, like, it's just like they're just standing there like shirtless talking to each other. It's just
there's one guy they're having a conversation where he's like, well, let me throw a shirt on and I'll go out and join you, and then it's like, nah, don't
do that, please don't. If you stay through the outtakes, through the credits rather, you can see in the outtakes the bizarre sight of Tyler Perry In the Madea getup, directing from the set. It's all synapses firing. I can't do it. So I'm saying 4. You're saying 4.5.
Yes.
Our number is 4.3. There is no tomato meter number yet for this because it has not screened.
Yeah, reviews only just started popping up this morning. So probably by the time this posts on YouTube, there may be a number, but at the moment we ain't got one.
I mean, and again, not that reviews matter. If you're going to see a Madea movie, you're going to see a Madea movie.
Exactly.
Yes. So now we are talking about Climax, the latest from French bad boy auteur Gaspar Noé. I was really, really pumped to see this movie just based on the trailer alone. This is, as Katie Walsh would say, very much my shit. So I was very excited about this, having loved Mandy, having loved Suspiria, having loved this kind of like crazy, lurid nightmare dream dance film. Please describe it to us, Matt.
So this group of dancers gets together and they work really hard and are working on a routine for an upcoming contest, for an upcoming dance event. And we're treated to this really stunning dance sequence in this really long take at the beginning of the film. And then they have a party to kind of celebrate and wind down, and someone spikes the punch and everyone goes berserk.
Somebody spikes the sangria with some especially potent LSD.
Yeah. I was really frustrated with this movie.
Okay.
Now, one of the things that I have it's not something I express that often for, I'm not sure why. I love dance movies. I actually love watching movies with dance in them. I'm really, really a big fan.
Okay.
And the dancing in this movie is stunning. Mm-hmm. The dance sequence. So the movie sits us through, the movie opens with us getting these video interviews of everyone that's in the crew, and you kind of get these brief introductions.
And they're from all over the world. Some of them are French, some of them are German.
Right. And you get this, you know, to the point that like it starts to wear out its welcome, but then the dancing starts. And when the dance starts, it's this one long one shot, and the routine is it's just jaw dropping.
What kind of dance is it? Describe it.
It's, you know, it's this group dance. It's a mix of all kinds of stuff, right? It's, you know, a lot of like what you would expect out of hip hop dancing. And then there's also clearly some, you know, some jazz elements to it. Not that I'm an expert, but what's fun about it is there's a lot of dancers who get their own moments to shine, but then the whole company will come together and have this. It's almost, there's times it felt like waves moving, that they'll all
undulating back and forth.
And they'll, you know, there'll be two or three soloists or two or three primary dancers doing routines back and forth. And the rest of the company is kind of pushing and pulling them and just, you know, kind of metaphorically, like they're not actually touching it. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And then there's a scene later in the movie where it's kind of like a dance circle, and everybody, you know, each of the dancers is getting this really, really interesting solo, and the camera's on the ceiling and it's looking down at them. And it's this really great kind of different look at the way each person dances, because you're so used to seeing them from the side, and right. And so to see that at the top, especially like there's certain of the female dancers that when they twirl, like their hair goes out and back in, and it's these tight, quick movements. The dance choreography in this movie is, and the way that shot is spectacular. And I love that. And I could have watched 2 hours of that.
Mm-hmm. But I hear a butt coming.
But as everybody has this terrible trip, you know, the trailers, I thought this movie was going to be something a little bit different than what it was, because as everyone gets more and more messed up on what happens to them after drinking the sangria, it just gets oppressive and obnoxious and tedious, because it just is like, okay, how many more bad things can happen? And really,
all
like,
the bad things happen.
And I just got tired of it. And you know, at one point, you know, the camera gets flipped upside down and stays there entirely too long.
So you're seeing them dancing and writhing. But the camera, yeah, like it's like on the floor, but it's upside down. So it's sort of like an inverse of what we saw with the cool overhead dance sequence.
Yeah, and it just started to feel like, you know, whereas it started to feel like, okay, enough already. Like it just started to feel really like almost masturbatory. Like, look what I can get away with. Look at the stuff I can do and make you sit through. And I was like, okay, I got it. All right, enough.
And that is the point, I think. I think the point is to make you feel as if you also are descending slowly into this visceral hell. Like you are there with them. Like just as the beginning was meant to be infectious and meant to make you want to be a part of this joyous expression of artistry, I think as the film drags on, and yet it does become repetitious, it does become a little monotonous. It's a challenge. This is a challenging sit toward the end. I feel like he's trying to make you feel as if you are there for better and for worse.
Yeah. I guess the difference is like, I didn't care enough about the characters that it really mattered. Right.
I mean, you get snippets of who they are.
But as opposed to say like Greta, right? Like Greta, you know, we're yelling at the screen, right? Like Greta we're watching and we're really yelling at the screen, 'cause we're really invested in what's going to happen to Francis and whoever else. This movie, you know, half the characters, like he spends so much time making so many of the characters, like when you do get little side shots of how these characters are, so many of them are so obnoxious.
Right.
Right. Like there's the two guys talking about getting with women. Right.
And it's really graphic
and it's really obnoxious. Uh-huh. And it's like, okay, I get that these guys are awful. All right. So something bad happens to them. Don't care. Right. And it just became that thing. Like so many of the characters, like when you do get some little bit of them, they come off nasty and almost despicable. And so, you know, okay, so bad things happen to bad people. But even then, like, I just was never emotionally invested in it in a way that, like, the dance caught me. The dance, I was like, oh, I want to see more of this. I want to really, like, see what's going on with these characters. And then after a while, I was like, I don't really care.
Do you feel like he's trying to shock you for shock's sake, ultimately?
Yeah, kind of. Like, I just felt like it was really self-indulgent after a while. Like, it was like, okay, fine.
If tonally it does become a little wearying, it is always really dazzling technically. You know, the way it's shot, the long tracking shots, the way different hallways and different rooms are lighted to create a feeling of the mood in each of these places. The overhead dance scene really subtly but very masterfully is a pivoting point, because you begin to feel there's a tension. That overhead dance scene begins joyously and like a genuine celebration, because that's not part of their routine they're practicing for. That's just like, we're partying and we're dancers and we're, you know, having fun with each other in a totally organic way. But that long shot, it begins to take a turn. The movements become a little more aggressive and a little more dangerous and a little more predatory almost. And that feels like a masterful kind of turning point there. And so I was always impressed with the way he did what he did, whether or not I could stomach what the result was on screen.
I agree with you. I just wish it would have went somewhere, because I felt like it just didn't really go anywhere. And it felt like, you know, my complaint with this is similar to my complaint about Tree of Life. Like, oh, can you do a big movie that really is 2 hours of stream of consciousness? Sure. All right. I'm impressed you managed to get that made. Doesn't mean I have to like it, right?
And this one's the same thing. Like, the dinosaur part was not stream of consciousness.
And so this one is somewhat similarly like, oh, can you really like show what it might be like to have go on a bad trip and you know, see a bunch of characters flip out? Like, yeah, all right, you got that made.
Let me ask you this.
Yay for you.
Let me ask you what you think about it as a statement of nationalism or not, because behind the DJ table, what's it called? DJ booth, whatever it's called.
Yeah, just where the DJ set up.
Yeah, there's like a French flag made out of red, white, and blue streamers kind of coming down. And the whole purpose of them practicing this routine is because they're going to go to the United States and perform in some kind of competition, whatever.
Right.
And so I wonder what, if anything, he is trying to, and maybe I don't have an answer myself. What is he trying to say about French nationalism at this point in time as like a nightmare scenario from which there is no escape? And the one person who gets kicked out is Muslim.
Hmm.
Right?
I guess.
The one person who gets kicked out into the snow outside is Muslim.
Yeah,
so I'm wondering what he's trying to say, and I'm working through it as I'm saying the words right now, like about the dangers of nationalism. Anyway, putting it out there for people who are smarter than I am who can ascertain these things.
So. Yeah. I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
I wish I mentioned Sophia Boutella is in this. Sophia Boutella is probably the only person that anybody watching this film will have heard of. She was in The Mummy. She was so great in Atomic Blonde. She originally was a dancer. And so she can really do all of this. And she's got like a leggy kind of sinewy energy about her. I mean, the casting is really fascinating because they all have different looks about them, different backgrounds, different dance styles. So that brings a great feeling of authenticity to it and to the dance scenes. And so you do truly believe that you're watching a dance troupe where, like, clearly the insularity of it is, you know, building to a boil and creating tension.
And the costumes back that up too, right? Because the costumes also, there's a lack of uniformity in that the costumes, you know, match up with, you know, they go part and parcel with people's individual dance styles and personalities. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, oh, everybody dresses kind of in a similar uniform.
Right.
Like it's a wild variation.
They're not like in leotards. They're not like in the same leotard, like the crunk guy is in a tracksuit.
Right. Yeah. I just, the movie kind of, I just got bored with it after, you know, once the dancing stopped, I kind of got bored.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. And yet though, it does create a lingering mood. Whether you want it to or not, it does kind of stick with you. And so when the lights came up in the screening that Matt and I went to, you're just sort of in this daze like, whoa.
Do we get to talk about the jerkwads that were in the movie
were at the screening? I guess. We had a really weird experience at the screening. I was sitting next to my good friend Justin Chang from the LA Times, and these two guys came in and sat on the other side of him, and one of the guys was on his phone for the beginning of the film and like wouldn't turn it off. And Justin, being the gentleman that he always is, asked very politely to please turn off the phone. And this guy was super surly, and there was like a back and forth between them. And then eventually the guy turned off the phone, and Justin leaned over and said, "Thank you." And the guy said, "I didn't do it for you, bitch."
Right. And then when the movie's over,
the second it ends,
like the guys get up and they start yelling at everybody.
It started out yelling at Justin. The guy is like wagging his finger and pointing at him and saying, "You should be ashamed of yourself. You're a disgrace." God.
Right.
It was really weird. And like none of us knew them. And they went storming out. And then the other guy steps on my foot as he's walking through the aisle. And I go, "Hey, you stepped on my foot." And he's like, "I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that." And he looked me in the eye and got down on my face and was like, "I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that." But as they're walking out, they're like yammering at us. And one of the guys says something about you and your fancy press row. So they're clearly not journalists. And then afterward, to their credit, the lovely folks who are the publicists for the film, like, apologized profusely to me and to Justin. And they were like, "I hear that an awful situation happened." They were friends of Gaspar Noé.
Turns out the director's friends showed up and were dicks in the movie. So
anyway,
you know,
my guess, though, also is that maybe they're just going from screening to screening to, like, get in everyone's face and be aggro just to, like, perpetuate the sensation of being accosted.
It's like a William Castle technique.
It was very effective. But all of us were just sort of stunned, like, what just happened?
Shit like that at press screenings. Last night at a Madea family funeral, phones came out, and they came out during the boring parts. I was like, more power to you. I'm not saying a word, you know, like, I totally get it. But at a press screening, when you are ostensibly surrounded by people who are there to work.
Exactly.
That's just
right.
In a small screening room.
No one loves movies more than film critics, right? Because, I mean, look, like, everybody's like, "Oh, film critics hate movies." Like, we do this because we love movies. Like, you'd have to be some kind of masochist to see movies.
If we get mad, we're disappointed.
Right. Mm-hmm. But so, press screenings are like the last, you know, critic screenings especially are like the last bastion of where you can reasonably expect that phones are not going to be out.
Right. Because we're all working. We're working. It's our job. Anyway, it was very strange. And also, it was at Raleigh Screening Rooms. It was a small screening room at Raleigh Studios.
I love, too, the guy's like, "It was an emergency." I'm like,
right.
Then take it outside.
Were you bleeding out?
Bitch.
Like, right. I'm sorry. Emergency? Like, no. Look, an emergency is like you go to the ER, right? Anything else, like, come outside and take your damn call.
And, yeah, I was going to say. But then his argument was, and just Justin said, like, "Well, you should have gone outside with your call then." He said, "I thought that would be more of a distraction."
Nope.
Anyway, it was all very strange. This is an anomaly. Like, people are usually very, very well behaved at press screenings.
We notice it because it's like,
yes. Whoa. And the folks at A24, who are lovely, were very quick to try to write this. So anyway. It was very strange. But it does not affect my number. I had a good time. I was saying 7.
I did not have a good time. and those a-holes did not really affect my number, but I give it a 3.5.
Okay. Ouch. So our number is a 5.3. It's at 82% on the tomato meter.
Seeing it this weekend.
This is a capital A art house movie. This is not for everyone. This is not everyone's cup of tea. It's not very much everyone's shit. So if it's not yours, you won't like it.
Right. When the ceiling shot ends, you can leave.
Aw. So much more happens then. Anyway, so Alonzo, I'll be curious to hear your thoughts when you see it.
I will share.
We are now going to talk about a really tremendous documentary called Apollo 11, which Alonzo will describe.
So, yeah, this is directed by Todd Douglas Miller, and it's basically an assemblage of footage around the Apollo 11 mission, wherein Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin became the first men to walk on the moon. And much of this is footage that's never been seen before, and it's certainly been, you know, restored and remastered. I didn't get to see this in IMAX, but I can imagine it's breathtaking in IMAX. And it really kind of takes the camera everywhere, from the building of the craft to the launch to the mission to the people in amazing 60s outfits watching the launch. There's no narration. There is occasional sort of use of animation to sort of explain what's going on and the science involved in trajectories and you know, gravitational pulls and that kind of thing. But it pretty much, the footage tells the story itself, and it's riveting. It's gorgeous to look at. It's very compellingly edited. It reminded me a lot of For All Mankind, where they took all of the moon missions and sort of edited them together into one big mission. But this one's purely focusing on Apollo 11. And, you know, it's definitely a great companion piece to First Man, whether or not you saw that film. But just a sort of straightforward storytelling, I just found this really exquisite.
Director also edited this.
Oh, well done.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know the whole backstory of how he got access to this, but I love the fact that there's no narration. I love the fact that there are no new talking heads explaining and holding our hands and walking us through it. It makes it so immersive, and the way it's all pieced together is so elegant. It's a word I know I overuse, but it really is here. Just the it's all just transmissions and old footage, and the fact that we know what happened, right? We know they made it. We know they got back. And the fact that we are holding our breath for so much of it, it's paced so beautifully that you get totally sucked in. Like, oh my God, oh my God, we only have a few more feet left until the thing is down. Are they going to make it? Are they going to land? Is it going to be okay?
I mean, it's not as hard in your throat as First Man is at times, because that movie really just rendered this whole thing just terrifying for me. But you're right. It is a sort of thing where they do manage to create these sort of little mini moments of suspense along the way. And it's the sort of thing where both of these films, I think, you know, decades down the pike, we kind of take for granted. Oh yeah, we landed on the moon. But like, all the stuff that went into making that happen, and all the millions of choices that had to be made, and all the millions of ways it could have gone terribly, terribly wrong. You know.
The fact that there was some sort of valve leak, like hours before they were about to blast off, they are like repairing some leak farther down the rocket.
Yeah, they're like T-minus 2 hours, and there's some hydrogen leak somewhere that somebody's got to go in and fix.
Yeah, I definitely came to appreciate First Man so much more after seeing this film and appreciating, you know, Damien Chazelle. We know he's got a tremendous eye for detail and for wanting to get it right and for being meticulous in every little thing. But I really appreciated that so much more having seen this.
Yeah.
And this came out months after First Man. First Man never really got much traction award-wise, although it did win for what? For
Visual?
No, production design was Black Panther.
Oh, you're right.
Visual effects, maybe? Anyway, it only won like one Oscar.
Was it a sound?
No. It should have won both sound. Remember, Bohemian Rhapsody won both of the sound categories. But it really made me appreciate, you know, every little bolt, every piece of clothing, every, you know, interior design element of First Man, because you see,
Visual effects, yes.
He really got it right.
And also just it kind of brings home the notion of we did this at a time when computers were, you know, the size of rooms and did less than what your phone can do. And everything is so analog, all those switches and things, you know.
Even the graphics to describe all of them are kind of delightfully minimalist and analog.
A little retro,
Little drawings that explain things that, like, A, I did not know, and B, it had never occurred to me because I don't know everything about the moon landing, but, like, it had to go around the Earth a couple times to, like, slingshot enough, like, energy. Did you know that?
I vaguely think I kind of knew that. The thing, what I always get confused about it when I think back about it is the coming back part.
They had to come back. It never occurred to me.
But they also really illustrate all of that really beautifully that you understand. Okay, so then they went from here to there, and then that went to this, and then that.
Well, not just come back, like, they got to leave because they got a slingshot back, too, right?
They
like,
had to go around the moon
leave
again.
A guy, right. Michael Collins is up in orbit by himself waiting for them to come back up, keeping the momentum going so that they can come back.
Then they have to attach to him in space. The thing I didn't know also is that, like, on the way to the moon, they, like, detach from their rocket, and then they reattach.
Backwards.
To the lander.
And it has to all happen, like, perfectly. As you say, Alonzo, like, 50 years ago with totally different technology. And they did it.
And then they had to land in a precise spot where the aircraft carrier could find them, you know.
Right. I love the score for this as well.
Right. Put it in perspective. Think of the cars. Think of the top of the line technology in cars at that time in the 60s. Versus now, right? Like, you can get a, you know, low-end, you know, Honda that's got more computer power than all of that put together now.
Like, a car that can parallel park itself has the Apollo lander beat by a mile.
Yes. It also made me appreciate Ryan Gosling's performance as Neil Armstrong that much more, because the thing that made Neil Armstrong perfect to lead this mission, right? The calm, the steadiness of him, the fact that nothing shook him at all, you realize here once again, how important that was, because every little thing has to go right.
Yeah.
Because if there's like the slightest tweak of anything, it could all go haywire. You need somebody in control who would be steady. And so the thing that made Ryan Gosling's portrayal of Neil Armstrong seem a little distant and a little enigmatic is also like the thing that works and why they all made it. So I appreciate it. And now I want to go back and rewatch First Man.
Yeah,
because
me too.
I only saw it that once, and we saw it in IMAX. Were you sitting next to me and
no,
Nick
I,
for that?
I saw it at the Venice Film Festival.
That's right, because you're fancy. No, but Matt, I was sitting with you. You were sitting with me and Nicholas at First Man,
First
right?
Man, yeah.
Right, in IMAX. And now I want to go back. And I think we all sort of...
It's another movie that gets boring when the dancing stops.
No, I think... I feel like I watched out of First Man appreciating it, but not loving it. And Apollo 11 makes me want to go back and see, like, how much more might I love it on second viewing. I brought Nick and Chris with me to a screening of this. And we also did not get to see it in IMAX, unfortunately. Mm. I think we saw it in 70, but it was not projected the way it was supposed to be in 70 because some of the stuff was cut off.
Oh, I think I saw it, probably just straight up digital. It was in one of those non-special upstairs AMC houses.
Oh, so. I saw it at the Landmark. Mm, okay. Anyway, but it's really cool. It's doing, if you're, I don't know what cities they're doing this in, but in a bunch of cities, they're doing it a 1 week run in 70 millimeter IMAX.
Nice.
Starting like today, March 1st. So if you can get anywhere, great. If not, it's going to be around for a
while. And
then
it opens wider on the 8th. Is that the deal?
It opens wider on the 8th. Yeah. So it's a total must see. Yes, you know how it ends. But still.
Yeah. Which, with many documentaries, you do, and they're still interesting.
Yeah. So I'm saying 9.
8.8. Yes. It's terrific. I highly recommend.
So 8.9 is our number. It's 100% on the tomato meter. Let's now talk about a horror movie. Yeah. We talked about a lot of scary things this week on the show, things that are disturbing.
And I swear it wasn't intentional that Matt and I did not see any movies together. It just weirdly worked out that way this week.
I didn't want to see Alonzo all week.
Yeah, screw that guy.
I've seen everything. I am the glue. So we're going to talk about...
You're the chewing gum.
I am the chewing gum. We're going to
bleachers.
We're going to talk about... Can I finish a sentence?
No.
No.
Sorry.
The hole in the ground. Matt, please describe it.
Want to hear my terrible joke about this movie?
No.
I kept getting this confused with my ass. Don't know my ass. Anyway.
Next week, Shinola.
Exactly. All right. So the hole in the ground. A young woman and her son have moved to a new town in Ireland or rural Ireland.
It's like the woods.
The woods. And they're in this house that's out in the woods. And they find this giant sinkhole. And one night the boy disappears and comes back, and maybe it's not actually the same boy that came back, and scariness ensues.
Yeah, this is really moody and atmospheric. This is the feature film debut from director and co-writer Lee Cronin. And he does a lot really, really effectively with mood and with pacing, and he will hold a shot. And for a long time, he mercifully refrains from cheap jump scares.
Right.
For a long time, it really is just about existential dread. And as a mom of a boy, as a parent of a boy, I expect this might have resonated with you as well. Just the notion that you don't really know your child is kind of unnerving, right? The notion
right.
that this person that you gave birth to, this person that you live with every day, this person who is a part of you, who you think you probably understand or at least connect with intimately in some way, maybe they're a total stranger.
Oh, Christy. Oh, wait till Nick hits his teenage years.
Oh, yes.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no,
because
I mean, yeah.
Now that Gabe is 15, I'm rethinking everything.
Nick is 9, and he's
it's done, all downhill.
Yeah, he's still my little baby, kind of. But I know that that's coming. I know it's coming.
I'm sorry.
So I know, as am I. But I guess, but that's a part of the rite of passage,
a lot of that going
right?
On in this movie.
That has to happen. But this is a little boy who's about 8, I would say, and looks like her kid, and quite often acts like her kid. But a mom just knows, right? You just know something's a little bit off, and there's already an underlying tension here because there's a separation from the dad. the two of them have like run off to this place together, this right. remote house. It's kind of a ramshackle house that she alone is trying to renovate. You see her like using a little scraper to get the old flowered wallpaper off of right. this place. And so they're trying to rebuild. So there's already a sense of a lack of foundation, a lack of stability. Things are in flux and you know, there's kind of a fragile hope of getting better. And then whatever she's established for them kind of gets yanked out from underneath them.
Yeah, I think this movie does, you know, it starts off really strong. Like you said, it's got a lot of good atmosphere to it. And even though I think it starts to tip its hand too early, there's some points in this where, you know, the movie kind of plays with, is she just imagining all this?
Right, right? She takes a lot of pills.
Right. And so the movie has hints of that, but I think it's after, but it doesn't really play that, and it doesn't start doing that. At least it didn't do that for me till after it's actually given you too many clues as a viewer. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the film, it kind of over-explains everything. And that's frustrating too, because I guess I want my metaphors to be a little bit, you know, less obvious.
Yes.
That being said, everybody's really good in this. The actress that plays the lead is fantastic.
Sienna Kerslake.
Yeah, she's really good in this.
She is. And the little boy's name is James Quinn. I can't read my handwriting.
And there's hints that, you know, this may have happened to somebody else previously. Uh-huh. And, there's kind of stories about it in the town about what might have happened. And, and again, it's the atmosphere is very good. I think that this could have been a much tighter script. You know, I feel like they needed, you know, that the director of Cronin needed to kind of decide what this movie was going to be. Is it going to be this metaphor about mental health and kind of past trauma, or is it going to be, mm-hmm. you know, a monster movie?
Right. And
the blending of the both, like, it's kind of pulling the wrong pieces in the wrong places. But that being said, I'd be interested to see what this director does going forward, because I think there's a lot of potential there.
Yeah. Once it spells everything out, it gets far less interesting. And I'm with you. I enjoyed the ambiguity of the metaphor, the tease of the metaphor, the potential open-endedness for interpretation. And then, yeah, once we like full on see what is exactly going on here, it's like, oh, it's that right. kind of movie. The boy's name is James Quinn Markey, and he's got sort of a creepy stillness to him that's quite effective here. And then also a veteran Finnish actress, Kati Utinen, is in this. And she has a couple of startling scenes as the woman in town who's right. creepy.
But the young actor can also be really cute and really, mm-hmm. you know, kind of precocious and fun, right? So he does a good job. Like some, you know, you sometimes see some young actors that, like, never seem cute. Mm-hmm. Like, they seem, you know, I would argue from Sixth Sense.
Haley Joel Osment
as a young boy was always, like, mm-hmm. seemed a little remote, right? A little aloof. Mm-hmm. And this kid can turn on the aloofness, but can also be just, like, the goofy 8-year-old.
Right, yeah. And that's tough as a child actor to be able to do both. So, yeah, you're right. He's very effective as giving glimmers of hope that right. he is indeed the boy she knows and loves, right? Right. It's well made, well shot, well acted, and I'm with you. Like, the script explains everything in a way that's frustrating, and I wish he'd maybe trusted a little more to let the creepiness of the metaphor linger a bit more. So my number is a 6.5.
That is my number.
Hooray!
As well.
That means no math for me. 6.5 is our number. It's at 89% on the tomato meter, which I'm suspecting is a lot of reviews, like a lot of 2.5 star yeah. reviews. But it's an effectively creepy movie for a long time. So the hole in the ground, see it or don't. It is now, for the last time, that magical time where we talk about True Detective. This was the finale, episode 8 of this third season of True Detective, which explains everything and answers all of our questions and ties up all of our loose ends.
And then keeps going.
Did you not enjoy this episode?
No. I didn't mean it to sound like that way, but just it comes to what looks like would be an organic conclusion for a lot of these shows, in that they sort of walk you through, here's what happened and here's who done it and da da da. And then I looked at, like, wait, there's another half hour. What's going to happen? Uh-huh. Oh, that's going to happen. But I think it ties in perfectly, because this whole season has been about Hayes's sort of, you know, memory issues. And so to close things out with the notion that he solves the mystery but can't remember,
is heartbreaking.
That he's solving the mystery is just like,
It's very consistent and also heartbreaking at the same time.
Yes.
Well, right, because one of the things this episode does is it presents us with another mystery that we hadn't really expected. Which is that she's still alive all along.
Right.
Right.
But she herself can't remember things either, because she's been force-fed lithium as a child.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, because we get the whole story from Mr. June, and, you know, he kind of confesses to everything, and wants punishment. And they just, which I thought was really powerful. He's like, oh, no, you have to arrest me. You have to do something. And they're like, no, bye.
You have to live with this, which is the worst punishment.
Right. Or do it yourself. Right. Yeah. Which, you know, I mean, especially because there's that line from Stephen Dorff from Randall where it's like, you got guns. Right. You can handle this yourself.
Yeah.
Like, they just have no interest. Right. Not our problem. They're not going to give him that out, which he clearly wants. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we find out, you know, or we get told by the nuns that she died. Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a gravestone.
Right. That that Julie had died, and that's the end of it. And, you know, you get this, you know, kind of flashback. Or not even flashback. It's
a dream, a visitation.
Right, Hayes, you know, kind of thinking like his wife would think, tells him, like, maybe there's a whole other level to this, right? Maybe the nuns were protecting her, and then he, you know, I mean, that to me was awesome, right? It's like suddenly another mystery that we hadn't even expected in the last episode, and then, oh, wait. And then he actually tracks her down, and then...
Because he's a detective.
Right, because he is a true detective.
Yeah.
And actually tracks her down, and then blanks out as to why.
I can't remember why. I know. Oh, that
which was kind of, which, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, either he can't, or does he make himself forget?
No.
Like,
I think he's genuinely, like, discombobulated when he pulls up to the house and can't recall what he's doing there.
Yeah, I think he stops just shy of the finish line and forgets that he's even in a race, basically.
Oh, see, I think for a moment I think there's a moment where he does realize he's found her. Like, right before he gets out of the car. Like,
maybe
he sees her from the car.
Yeah,
and I think, I wonder if the excitement of it, like, causes kind of
that last
breakdown, and then...
I was also fascinated that it turns out that he is not estranged from the daughter.
Right.
Right.
Which we've been sort of led to believe this entire time. But
as
again,
if there was going to be a reveal of some sort.
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing
that.
Myself well, okay. So you adjust me as necessary.
Yes. No, but I think there's the tease of the possibility that we're going to get an explanation as to what the falling out might have been with the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's none. It's just that she left... And she's in California.
Yeah.
And she doesn't want to be in Arkansas anymore.
And, right. And who can blame her?
And who can blame her?
Just kidding, Arkansas.
This is a lovely part of Arkansas. But and then we also get a quick visit into that fourth timeline, right? Of when, or is it a whole fifth timeline where we see that he becomes the head of security at the University of Arkansas and he visits Amelia as she's lecturing in a classroom? Is that the same timeline as him dropping off his daughter at college timeline?
Yeah, right around there.
Or is that a whole other timeline?
I guess so, because in 90, is she still teaching at the elementary school or is she just writing full time?
She's writing the book in 90.
Again, right? Yeah, she's writing the book and raising their two children. So, yeah, I guess that's probably part of
the same
daughter
college.
In college timeline. Yeah.
Yeah, so the episode's called Now Am Found, and that is quite literal because he does find the truth. Mm. And yet, there's also a very sad, bittersweet irony to that because he can't, you know, share with Roland whatever the truth is. But then there's hope there at the end that after 25 years and the fractious nature of why their friendship fell apart, that there's going to be hope for the two of them
right.
to spend some more time together.
Right. And obviously the title is a reference to yeah. Amazing Grace. And so, you know, there is a certain grace that comes with that. But then there's the ending, which I need somebody to walk me through because I'm not sure.
Let's talk about it. Okay.
So we end with this sudden, the last, well, I guess the last two flashbacks, really. One of them is where he proposes to Amelia. And then from there, it's a jump back to him. The one time, the only time in the show that we jump back to his being in Vietnam.
Right. The absolute last thing we see is him tracking.
Yeah. And the last thing we see is he's tracking and he disappears into the jungle. And I don't know if that's a metaphorical, like then his mind just shuts down at that point or what that means.
Interesting.
I mean, if I were to interpret it as a metaphor, I would say that it's that the tracker has gone back out, like disappeared into the jungle. Like the tracking side of him is done, like found.
Okay.
Right. It's like even right. It's oh, he's not. He's done. He's going back out. Like he's disappearing, fading away, back into the jungle. Doesn't need to be tracking out here in the civilized world anymore.
It's one last glimmer of that greatness, that wonderful
yeah.
talent, that gift he
yeah.
had for this. And
right.
now he can let go of it.
Right.
Because he's found her.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And he doesn't even consciously know that he's found it, but he does know that he can stop.
Yeah, there's an unexpected bit of uplift to that, to the last moments of him and Amelia, mm-hmm. right? Because there's right. still a flirty banter and a sweetness, and there's a connection there that seemed to have kind of dissipated as the years went on. And there's also the glimmer of him at his peak. You know, I mean, it was during Vietnam, of course, but it also was the height of him using his abilities
right.
for good.
And that last moment, I think, also sort of establishes that the two of them understand the complication of the relationship as far as him being a cop, her being a writer who wants to write about the things that he's investigating, and sort of acknowledging in each other the things that why their relationship shouldn't work, but also why it does.
And they have to understand that they can't always tell each other everything.
Yeah.
And that's right. going to just have to be okay.
Yeah. What do we think of the opening scenes with...
With Michael Rooker?
Yeah.
Oh, Michael Rooker's in this. Yes. Yeah. So good.
Very intense. right. Because I love the veiled threat of, are you threatening me?
Well, and the other thing I liked is that Rooker as... Hoyt is Hoyt's like there's I don't know what you're asking about, like he legit didn't know some of that stuff, right? Like, oh wait, Hoyt's not doesn't have all the answers here, right? I mean, we start the show out with Hoyt wants to know where his guy went, and he knows some of the stuff, but like after Julie's gone, he doesn't know what happened to her, and we realize later why Hoyt doesn't know, mm-hmm. right? Like Hoyt had to know that she was being kept there, but once Julie disappears, he's not part of some conspiracy to find her again. Like
yeah.
he, you know, like when he says, you know, it takes us till we get June's confession to understand why Hoyt is saying, look, if you keep looking for her, we're going to have to put her down so that none of this blows back on her. But if she just quietly disappears, then nobody
right.
finds out anything we did.
Right. It's interesting too, that in the previous episode, it dangles the possibility that this season is connected to season one with the sex trafficking ring, and it's not.
Yeah, not really.
That's not what she's being kept for. She's not being
right.
kept as a sex slave.
Right.
She's being kept as like a surrogate daughter.
Yeah.
So that right. part's interesting too, that it kind of dangles that red herring there, but that's not what's going to ultimately be
right.
the truth of what, you know,
right.
it wasn't a sexual thing. It wasn't like she was being held for Hoyt's sexual pleasure. She
right.
was being held in a sad, twisted, but more pure reason.
Right. right. Which explains why her father looks at the drawing and says, Julie, like, cause he would have recognized her drawing.
Right,
the drawing on the wall.
Right,
right,
right, right.
Right. Also, my crazy theory about the filmmaker being the daughter of Julie is totally wrong.
Right, because yeah. that little girl is much younger. Right?
And obviously, it's also, you know, we find out that the death of the son was purely by accident.
Right. And that they just place him that way because they didn't know what else to do with him.
Yeah.
Right. And it wasn't some kind of ritualistic sacrifice.
Right.
It wasn't a demonic possession thing.
Yeah, and Julie had seen the photo and just, like, you know, reenacted it.
Right. And thought that would be a nice way, didn't know what else to do. There's a childlike innocence to it.
Yeah,
yeah, it's interesting. All the, like, the most depraved avenues this thing could have gone down, it then, like, pulls back from all of them.
Yeah, because also, like, there's that whole thing about the corn husk dolls being some about, you know, the grooming and the procuring.
No. So what's the point of all that, do you think? Just to fuck with us or, like, just to show that things aren't as bad as they seem?
Well,
what is that about?
I mean, it also shows, you know, like, you look at, you know, especially, like, you at that time, like, you start looking at, like, oh, what kind of satanic stuff is going on here? Like, you go to, you know, and how following certain clues can almost cause a bias in that you're missing things otherwise.
They're simpler.
Right.
You're ignoring the clues that don't support your sort of your confirmation bias. But I don't think the show is trying to say that that stuff doesn't happen or doesn't exist. It's just saying that there are always multiple paths in any investigation and that you need to sort of, you know, be open to all of them.
Right. It gives us something to focus on in the first four episodes.
Right. So so now that it's all wrapped up, what do you guys think about this season compared to seasons one and two?
Well, I mean, I think two, everyone agrees, is a disappointment, and there's good things in it, but it's ultimately just, it's a bit of a mess and doesn't hold together as well. I don't know that I would want to rank one and three. I like both of them a lot. I think they're different enough from each other that it's not a question of, well, this one's better, that one's better. I think they're both really good and they're really strong, but they have different points of view and different narrative approaches, although a lot of parallel as well in terms of the multiple timelines and that kind of thing. I would say they're both great.
Yeah, I will say I like them both. I think this one has a more satisfying ending. In that
the solution to the crime actually matters.
Well,
more.
it matters, not just matters more, you know, and partly because of what happens to Hayes as he's much, much older and what he ultimately, you know, that's that other, the mystery behind the mystery, as, Amelia says, but also, you know, all of the kind of super terrifying, you know, satanic molestation style red herrings that came up early, like, we kind of get answers to those. Whereas in the first season at the end, you know, and they address this, like, Rust Cole's like, somebody else will take care of the rest of this. And you're like, whoa, wait a minute. Hang on. Like, we still need that season of somebody breaking that whole ring down because that still hasn't happened.
True. You should go back and watch season one. Michelle Monaghan's in it.
She's very lovely, yes. I should do that. So I really enjoyed watching TV with you guys.
Yay.
Let's watch something else. What else should we watch?
You should get caught up on Game of Thrones.
No.
We might do some kind of Game of Thrones-ish thing. We're still toying with the possibility of how we're going to address this final season of Game of Thrones.
And we're also getting very close to setting up our Patreon, and it's quite possible that the movie stuff will be free and podcasted and available on YouTube, but maybe TV becomes a Patreon perk. So
maybe.
Stay tuned. We'll figure out how that's all going to work out. But in the meantime, we thank you for watching. You can let people know that we're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BeFastAllDay, and that they can subscribe to us here at YouTube or at any of their favorite podcatchers and, you know, leave us positive feedback in all those places. That would be great. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. It's been a great week. Thanks for sticking around with us. We'll talk to you real soon. Bye.
Bye.